The laws of war are intended to protect the innocent as well as combatants. Today's guest argues that they are also intended to provide justice after conflicts end. He's Alan Ryan this week on Story in the Public Square. Hello and welcome to Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University in Newport, Rhode Island. As always, I'm joined by my friend and co-host, G. Wayne Miller of the Providence Journal. Each week, we sit down with scholars and storytellers to make sense of the narrative shaping American public life. This week, we're joined by Alan A. Ryan, who led the U.S. Justice Department's effort to bring Nazi war criminals to justice in the Reagan administration. And he's written three books about war crimes, from the Second World War to the War on Terror. Alan, thank you so much for being with us.
Jim, nice to be here.
So, earlier in your life, you were a captain in the United States Marine Corps.
I was.
You went to law school. You clerked for Justice Byron Wright. Byron White on the Supreme Court.
Yes.
And then you turned your attention to war crimes.
Yes.
Tell us about that journey.
I was in the Justice Department in the office of the Solicitor General, which argues cases in front of the Supreme Court. And a case came up through the federal ranks that had to do with a fellow in Florida who had been a guard at Treblinka, which was one of the most notorious of the Nazi death camps. And nobody knew anything about it, including me. Nobody knew, really, how do you go about dealing with a case like this. So I said, what the heck, I'll give it a try. And it turned out to be a fascinating case. It did eventually go to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court held that if you were a Nazi war criminal and then did not disclose your background when you came to the U.S., your citizenship could be revoked and you could be deported. So that's when the office was set up finally to specialize in that. I became the director because, as the Attorney General said, you've only tried the one case, but that's more than anyone else.
Wow. So, you know, we live a sort of an isolated existence where we don't think today that these war crimes still exist, but they do.
They do.
And so why should the American public care?
Well, I sometimes hear that question as it applies to Nazi war criminals. And now, in the year 2017, virtually all of them are dead. But when we started out in 1980, the average age of veterans of the German war effort and the SS were 65 years old. I don't consider that particularly old, being past that age myself. So the question then is not so much today Nazi criminals as it is the war crimes that are taking place in other parts. And they are taking place all over the world, in Syria most obviously, but also in many nations in Africa and in other places as well. So it's not something that's ever going to go away.
I think for a lot of our audience, the whole concept of war crime is perhaps not entirely understood. And it's predicated, of course, on the fact that there are laws of war.
Yes.
Which I think might be even more or subject to discussion and clarification. So talk about how can there be a law of war? Isn't war by its very definition
killing people?
Killing people, yes.
That's what it is. And I start my class at Harvard and Boston College Law School by saying, if you think law of war is an oxymoron, you're probably right. How can you bring law and apply it to the lethal act of killing people? And the answer that we develop over the course of time is that you have to look at the law of war as being really the beginning of human rights law, because what it says is, even though my army is fighting your army and I am trying to kill your soldiers and you're trying to kill mine, still there are things that we will not do. We will not attack civilians, we will not torture, we will not shoot the wounded, we will not attack hospitals. And it, when you look at it as a way that serves the interest of both sides, that hospitals should be spared, civilians should be spared, towns that are not defended should be spared, it does bring a certain benefit to both sides. Now, that's not to say that it's never been violated. It's violated all the time. But the fact that the law is there and that there are some times when it's not violated does tend to protect people who shouldn't be part of the war.
There's a code of morality embedded in that very concept. What are the roots of that? Are they philosophical? Are they religious, historical? I mean, where did civilization today get to that understanding?
You can find roots in all of those disciplines, religion, philosophy, and so forth. But I think really it arose more than anything else out of the military itself, out of the fighting forces themselves, the code of the warrior. Even if you look at some of the Indian, the South Asian, the Hindu sages who wrote about, you don't kill women, you don't kill children, you don't torture people or wound them unnecessarily, because that dishonors the important responsibilities of a warrior. So I think that's really where the roots are of what we today consider the law of war, even though other disciplines have certainly had an influence.
So we're going to talk, I think, at length here about sort of war crimes and some of the issues associated with that. But in sort of more day-to-day aspects, can you give us an example of for our audience to understand what we're talking about when we talk about the laws of war? Is there any way that we would sort of associate
it? Sure. The most familiar ones, I think, to most people would be the Geneva Conventions, mm-hmm. which have been around for 100 years, and which basically there are four of them, and they basically are fairly straightforward. They say you do not attack the wounded or the sick or the hospitals or the doctors or the medical people. You treat prisoners of war humanely and provide bedding and food and clothing and shelter and decent treatment until the war is over, and you don't mistreat civilians. Particularly civilians when you are an occupying army and the civilians are of some other nationality and you are there to keep them in line, but you do that without undue discipline or cruelty. That's really what's at the heart of all of this. I mean, if you had to reduce the laws of war just to something that you could carry on a card, which many nations, including the U.S., do give to their troops, that's really what it comes down to. You can write hundreds of pages of wisdom about what it all means, but really that's the core of it.
So am I right in thinking that that for the laws of war to apply, they apply specifically to people in regular military units in uniform, representing a specific nation? Is there?
Well, they do, but they also apply to others who are maybe not in uniform, but who are acting under the orders of the military unit, and there are certain criteria they have to fulfill. The problem, though, is that, as we know, wars are no longer fought exclusively, or maybe not even necessarily, by armies representing nation states that are aligned on a battlefield going at each other. And one of the questions, I think, that really plagues the laws of war and those of us who care about it is that they sounded perfectly good at the end of World War II.
Right.
But that was a long time ago. They haven't really been changed all that much since then. And we don't fight wars like we fought World War II anymore. Now, we even have difficulty trying to distinguish between what is war and what is crime. Was 9/11 an act of war, as President Bush at the time lost no time in saying, or was it a series of crimes?
Right.
That determines whether you deal with it in a military fashion or with a law enforcement perspective. And that makes all the difference when it comes to what follows.
So in terms of setting these definitions, do I assume correctly that it's the United Nations that is the body that does that?
Well, the United Nations puts out a lot of rules and regulations, but it's really international law is international law only to the extent that nations are willing to follow it. If nations signed a treaty, as virtually every nation has done with the Geneva treaties, then it's pretty easy to look at it and say, well, that's the treaty, that's what the law is. But a lot of international law is what's called customary international law. It's sort of like common law. It's not really written down. It's not in a treaty. It's things like the freedom of the high seas and things like that, or the immunity of diplomats for many years, that nations just sort of followed because it was in their interest to do so.
So any law without a mechanism for enforcement and punishment is a toothless law. It's not even really a law. What is the mechanism for?
I wouldn't say it's toothless. What I'd say is it's not enforceable necessarily by arresting people and putting them in jail. But when international law is violated, as it was, say, in the Cuban Missile Crisis, there are a lot of ways, from embargoes to diplomatic sanctions to pulling back your ambassador and cutting off communication. There are a lot of ways that nations can deal with each other short of actually sending in the troops or sending in the cops.
But we think of the war crime trial sort of as the archetypal enforcement, punishment.
Yes,
mechanism. Who conducts trials like that today?
The International Criminal Court, which was established in 2002, is certainly doing that. We are seeing the wind-up of the International Tribunal for Yugoslavia and for Rwanda, which dealt with war crimes of the 90s. But those really were the first ones since Nuremberg in 1945. Nuremberg was really the first. Yeah. And for almost 50 years, it was the only. Because of the Cold War and the U.S. and Soviet Union would not tolerate the other taking any advantage that might come about through a trial. So it was only at the end of the Cold War that the United Nations created these special tribunals for the breakup of Yugoslavia, where there were horrendous war crimes committed, and also for the genocide in Rwanda. And then the idea of a permanent sitting criminal court was established in 1998, and it became a reality in 2002. The U.S. is not part of that. There are other nations that are also not part of it, but that's what's out there.
Why doesn't the United States participate in the ICC?
Well, I think it goes back to the administration of George Bush the Younger, because I think President Clinton was all for it.
Yeah.
And in fact, the treaty was signed by President Clinton, although it was never submitted for ratification. When George Bush was elected president, he basically said, we're having nothing to do with international organizations, particularly ones that can put American soldiers in jail. Mm-hmm. And even Colin Powell, in his confirmation hearing, said, don't hold your breath waiting for us to join the ICC, because we're not going to, and to this day we haven't. I think President Obama would have been perfectly willing to do it, but he'd never get it through the
Senate. We need to take a quick moment for station identification. This is Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. An audio version of the show can be heard three times each weekend on Sirius XM Satellite Radio's popular Politics of the United States. That's the POTUS Channel 124. Story in the Public Square is produced each week by a tremendous team at Rhode Island PBS, and we're lucky to work with them. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University. If you want to follow me on Twitter, I'm at JM Lutis. To my right, co-host G. Wayne Miller is an award-winning journalist with the Providence Journal. He's tweeting at G. Wayne Miller. And our guest this week is Alan A. Ryan, author of three books, including the 9/11 terror cases, Constitutional Challenges and the War Against Al-Qaeda. He's also the co-producer of a three-part PBS series, Dead Reckoning, that explores war crimes and their prosecution. So we're going to talk a little bit about Dead Reckoning in a moment, but I want to, more broadly, why is the prosecution of war crimes, why is justice after a war ends important?
Why is justice after a crime is committed important? It is necessary, whether it is a bank robbery or a murder or a war crime, it's necessary for the society in which we live, be it the United States or Rwanda or any place else, to say, this is not right. We don't tolerate this. And when it happens, we punish those who did it. The piece that is necessary in that equation is that it has to be just. It cannot be a circular firing squad, as it was once suggested after Nuremberg. It has to be a fair trial. As Justice Jackson, who was the chief prosecutor at Nuremberg, said, we should not put anyone on trial who we are not prepared to say is not guilty, if the evidence shows that they're not guilty. And what we accomplish, I think, through the trial is a sense of fairness, a sense of assurance, a sense of justice, if you will, that says we know we did the right thing here because we had a fair process in which the burden of proof was on the state to show that there was guilt under the law, to present the evidence, to have a fair decision made. And when all of those things happen, then we can say it is fair that this person now be punished. And sometimes when the verdict comes back not guilty, you say, well, I'm disappointed, but that's the way the process works, and that's the way we have to accept it.
Is there a link between this kind of justice and peace? Peace among nations, peace between nations.
I believe in no justice, no peace. It's not just a slogan. I think that it may be difficult to draw a direct line and say, well, look, all of these nations that were dedicated to justice, they never had a war. That's actually, unfortunately, not true. But I don't see how you can have a lasting peace if there is an overlying sense that things were done wrongly, that the people who committed crimes weren't punished, or that the people who were punished were not those who were guilty of crimes. I don't see how that can be a foundation for peace at all.
So we mentioned your book looking at the war crimes and the war on terror.
Yeah.
Is the idea that there are laws of war quaint? Is it outdated by the fact that the war on terror is so fundamentally different?
If you look at the Geneva Conventions, there are parts of it that appear quaint. I mean, there's a provision in there that says that the commandant of the POW camp has to provide or allow the prisoners of war to have recreational equipment and to play sports and games. But that overlooks the bigger point, which is that fair treatment of prisoners is a requirement that serves the humane aspects of war. There are too many aspects of war that are not humane. So the requirement that those who are defenseless prisoners and non-combatants are protected is really a matter of self-interest, I think.
So does the West tie its hands in holding to these principles in the so-called war against terror, against terrorists who don't adhere to or embrace any of these?
The problem is that we did not tie our hands very much in the years after 9/11. The evidence now is irrefutable that the United States engaged in torture, that it engaged in wholesale mistreatment of prisoners at places like Abu Ghraib and elsewhere. It is not something where we can say somehow that this, if we had followed the law, it would have impaired our ability to fight terrorism. I don't see any connection at all in that respect.
So would some of these abuses that you just described at Gitmo and Abu Ghraib be considered war crimes themselves?
Yes.
And so why hasn't anything happened about that?
Well, the political, both President Bush and President Obama both made the decision not to prosecute those who had taken part. And there are some rationales for that. The Justice Department, for example, issued a legal opinion that was very broad in what the CIA and the military could do, and it would be seen perhaps as unfair then to turn around and punish them for doing it. But again, the question of whether somebody should be punished, whether there should be enforcement, is one part of the equation. The question whether these laws should exist at all is the other. And the thing that it concerns me as we go forward is do we face a situation where the laws of war are simply obsolete? That when we talk about cyber warfare, or we talk about the sort of proxy wars that take place, that the laws that we have simply are not responsive to that anymore. Drone warfare, autonomous weapons, cyber warfare, all of these things, you really have to stop and think, do they apply to the matrix that we've created over this period of time?
And is the public, and not just the American public, but the global public, ready and willing to grapple with sort of what could autonomous weapons commit war crimes? And who do you hold responsible? And are we ready to engage in that sort of global consensus building around norms for the future of conflict?
There are people who are focused on that and who are trying, and I give them credit, but we're still a long way from consensus.
I want to ask you one question, sort of more contemporary in nature. As a candidate, Donald Trump said that if he was president, he would have no compulsion ordering people, I think he said, to torture and a hell of a lot worse. What's the impact that that has on the global community that's concerned about these issues, and also just on the conduct of others in the international arena?
Well, fortunately, people who knew better, which was not hard to find when you're talking about Mr. Trump, but James Mattis, the Secretary of Defense and a former four-star general in the Marine Corps, basically sat him down and said, look, torture doesn't work. I mean, John McCain, who has been an outspoken critic of torture in any form and who underwent 5 years of torture himself during the Vietnam War, said, you reach a point, no matter how strong your resistance is or how determined you are, you reach a point where you'll tell them anything they want to hear just so they'll stop the pain. Yeah. Time after time after time, the most effective prosecutions of terrorists and war criminals have come through the U.S. Justice Department and the FBI in federal courts in the United States. When you're talking about the CIA, which was never a law enforcement organization, carrying out things at black sites in Poland and Thailand and God knows where else, those were complete failures, both from an intelligence point of view, from a legal point of view, from a human rights point of view. They were utter fiascos.
And that's one of the big challenges with the detainees still at Gitmo, is how can you prosecute these folks, whether it's military yes. commission or civilian court, with evidence that is tainted by torture?
Yes. And there are commission proceedings that are going on. I've talked with the chief prosecutor, who I think is doing a very good job in trying to salvage the best that can be done, but I'm not sure that that's going to ever succeed.
There are strong elements of morality in the need and desire for human rights underpinning our conversation here. Mm-hmm. And yet we live in this country, on this planet, at a time of great fear. Fear in many different ways. And fear makes people approach issues differently. Is there any opportunity in this environment of fear to get these sort of fundamental messages across, that there is a need to have morality in war or outside of war, and that human rights do matter? I mean, we sort of saw a lot of that brushed aside recently in political events in our own country. And certainly if you look abroad, you see other examples.
The answer to that, Wayne, is there is, and it is called the rule of law. And in my book on the 9/11 terror cases, the constitutional issues that were raised there, what I tried to do is to say, look, you had three branches of government, the president, the Congress, and the Supreme Court, each of which was in conflict with the other two over how to deal with these issues, where the Supreme Court twice struck down as unconstitutional what Congress had done. Congress, in some cases, did not do what the president was asking it to do. And the lesson that comes out of all of that is that in the end, the Supreme Court, although its decisions were not always well received, in the end, it issued decisions, and those decisions were respected. Congress said okay, the president said okay. What I'm afraid of now, particularly with the pardon of Sheriff Arpaio out there, is that we have a president who is saying, why should I follow what the courts say? Yeah. And that, to me, really attacks the underpinnings of order in this country, which is the rule of law.
That's a heck of a topic. I want to, we're almost out of time. I want to talk, though, about one of your books, Yamashita's Ghost, which is a look at the war crimes prosecution of Japanese General Yamashita in the Philippines after the Second World War.
Yes.
And the question it raises in my mind is whether or not post-war crimes trials are really just the vengeance of the victors.
In that case, I think it was. That was Douglas MacArthur saying to five of his subordinates, put this man on trial because he survived and he was the commanding general for the terrible atrocities that took place in the Philippines. What also emerged from the trial is that not only did he not order them, he ordered the troops to abandon the city. He himself was 120 miles away in the jungle. He had no knowledge of what was happening. And yet, because he was the surviving general, he was put on trial, convicted, and eventually hanged. So in that case, I think it was certainly a miscarriage of justice. Incipient nature of that was, the motivation behind that was MacArthur's desire for vengeance, period. It happens.
Yeah.
Big question, little time, always happens on this show. Do you have faith that the rule of law will prevail in America?
And you got about 30 seconds.
Yes.
And you'll need it too.
It will, Wayne, because the United States is bigger than Donald Trump.
That's good to hear.
And
that you have faith in this.
I don't know how long he will be in office. Nobody does. But I have faith that this country knows better and is bigger than Donald Trump.
Alan Ryan, thank you so much for being with us. The PBS series is Dead Reckoning. The books are many, and you ought to check them out. We want to thank our listeners and our viewers, too, for joining us this week and every week. And if you want to know more about Story in the Public Square, please follow us on Facebook and Twitter, or you can visit us at pellcenter.org, where you can also see past episodes. For G. Wayne Miller, I'm Jim Lutis, asking you to join us again next week for more Story in the Public Square.